I'm very happy now to welcome David Huron. He is a professor at Ohio State University in both the School of Music and the Center for Cognitive Science, where he heads the Cognitive and Systematic Musicology Laboratory. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So you are a musicologist by training, but you have gone deeply into the scientific study of music. Now, we know that music evokes emotion in probably just about everybody, but the same music will evoke different emotions in different people. One person loves something, another person hates that same thing. Are there any universals? Are there anything you can say about music that everybody loves or hates?
Yes, there are definitely, there are definitely ways in which we behave very similarly. But as you quite rightly point out, there are large individual differences and large cultural differences in our musical responses. And some of those are attributable things like personality. So we know that people who are, for example, that score high on neuroticism are more likely to enjoy listening to sad music, for example. We also know there are differences in the sexes between males and females about how they experience music. Of course, differences between musicians and non-musicians. But there are also some important cultural differences as well.
As an aside, a friend of mine once said, "Show me anybody in the world who doesn't like Ave Maria."
I'm sure they exist. I'm sure they exist, and there are probably some in your listening audience that says, "Oh no, not that piece." There are certain aspects to music, certain features that we can point to that that are definitely important in terms of likes and dislikes. Especially in terms of disliking, there are some, in the same way that an infant, if you take hot pepper, for example, and you take the extract, something called capsaicin, and you put it on the tongue of a newborn infant, they're going to reel. They're not going to find that pleasant at all. If you take a little eyedropper with some sugared water, they're going to find it very pleasant, and they're likely to smile and so on. Now, as we get older and culture starts playing a bigger role, you find these differences where some people like it hot, and they'll enjoy the hot pepper, and then other people will sort of recoil at things that are terribly sweet or seemingly excessively sweet and so on. So there are these differences that arise later on, but you can see these sort of innate or at least biologically prepared kinds of responses very early on. We see that with things like dissonance, for example.
So people hate dissonance and what, love harmonious intervals?
Well, let's talk about newborns. So newborns will recoil. They will show some anxiety when they hear certain kinds of sounds that we would describe as dissonant. And actually, it all makes sense. Let me use a visual analogy here. There are certain visual things that people will just simply find annoying. If I take my hand and I hold it up in front of your face, in front of your eyes, I mean, you'll think that I'm an idiot, and you'll certainly be annoyed. But there's an excellent reason for being annoyed. What I've done by putting that visual obstruction there is I've reduced the capacity of your visual system to extract information out of the environment. So there are excellent reasons why we should be unnerved or unhappy or anxious or annoyed by things like that. And there are certain sounds, the same thing can happen with sounds. There are some sounds that can obscure other sounds, we call it masking, and some sounds that can do it more than other kinds of sounds. And we respond to that by feeling a kind of annoyance, which would normally make us want to get out of there. Let me give you some more examples in vision. So I'm a person who wears glasses. If I take my glasses off, I see the world out of focus, and it's just simply not as enjoyable. I have a kind of pleasure that happens when I put my glasses on. Another thing that we find annoying is, you know, imagine you're driving a car and you come up to a stop sign and you look to the left, and then as you look to the right, you're staring directly into the sun, and you have this visual glare, and it's very annoying. And then finally, something like fear of the dark. If you walk into a cave and you don't have a flashlight or something like that, there's a point at which you just get unnerved about being in a place that's completely dark. In each of these cases, visual obstruction, lack of focus, visual glare, and darkness. There are excellent reasons why you should be annoyed, excellent reasons why you should find it uncomfortable, and why you'd want to fix it in some way. So in each of these cases, there are auditory analogs. There are analogs in sound that are also sort of annoying. Now, that's not to say that we can't use those as a kind of musical spice, especially, as I said, for adults. There's a point, some like it hot, and you can do the same thing. You can do the same thing with music. For example, heavy metal, there are a number of aspects to heavy metal which are really sort of sonically in your face, and they will activate your amygdala. They will generate things that subcortically very strongly resemble fear. And one of the things that we know is that there are differences, for example, between males and females, broadly speaking, in terms of how tolerant they are for fear. And so the people who are most tolerant are people who have the highest levels of testosterone. And those are typically males, and they're typically males of a certain age. So that boom car driving down the street that's, you know, with the windows rattling and the subwoofer going and so on, we all know what kind of person is in that car. You know, it's probably a male who's probably 20 to 25 years of age. And part of the reason why they do that is because the high levels of testosterone raise the threat threshold. So they're the same sort of people that need to have a really heavy-duty roller coaster in order to get the same thrill. That as I've grown older, I've done something very typical as a male. I'm nearly 60, and the testosterone levels drop. I can vouch for that with age, and so your risk tolerance declines with that as well.
So in terms of, I mean, you were talking about the visual analogs, like somebody waving a hand in front of your face, or not seeing clearly, or being in the dark. I mean, all of those things are pretty clearly about survival. I mean, adapting to your environment and being able to survive and not get attacked by a predator or whatever. And there are probably sound analogs to that, like being aware of rattlesnakes and roaring animals and the footfalls of big predators and things like that. And all of those things make sense. But what about music? I mean, what's the difference between music and sound?
Well, there are many things to say here. So culture plays a very important role here. One of the most important determinants of what kind of music people enjoy listening to, sadly, is familiarity. There's that old saw that familiarity breeds contempt, but that's definitely not the case in terms of sound. Now, when people are consciously aware that you're playing the same things to them, what they'll do is consciously they'll say, I need some novelty. I like novelty. But actually their behavior betrays their feelings. So what we find with sound recordings, for example, if we pick up your iPad or something, your iPod, and we look at what you've been listening to, people tend to listen to the same pieces over and over and over again. About a small number, I remember a statistic a number of years ago in the days of albums, that something like 80% of the music listening that people did from their album collection was the same five or six albums each time. So familiarity plays a big role, and part of familiarity is what you're exposed to in your culture. And by culture, I don't just simply mean your sort of national culture, but it also means the peer group that you live in. So that plays an enormous role, and there are many other aspects of culture, the learned aspects of our experience that will shape how it is that we enjoy and the meaning that we derive from music. But Mother Nature is not very far away. So many of these very basic things that we've been talking about with regard to vision, those same things can be identified with regard to audition. A helpful way of thinking about this is that when you look at the neuroscience, the brain really looks like two different things. It looks like we have really two brains. There's a kind of subcortical brain, which is very fast and very conservative and very sort of anxious about the world and kind of has a dim view about things and is always sort of overreacting. And it's unconscious. And then there's another part to the brain, the kind of cortical part. You can think of it as the the thinking brain, the conscious brain. It's the brain, it's the me that I'm aware of. And often what the conscious part of the brain is doing, the cognitive cortical part, is subduing these little monsters underneath these subcortical things that are responding in particular ways. So a large part of human behavior, for example, is, you know, if you walk into a shop, subcortical structures are saying things like, I want that, and I'm going to take that, and I think I'm just going to steal it. And it's the cortex that comes in and says, no, this is not right. And you find these inhibitory signals, which are really trying to subdue these very automatic responses, these subcortical responses. So the same thing happens with music. There are really two sort of experiences that we have. One are these constant subcortical structures that are responding all the time to sounds. And they're responding to music in the same way that they would respond to doors slamming and, you know, other kinds of sounds, you know, bears growling and so on in the world. And then there's the cortical part. That's the thinking part. That's the meaning part. That's what do I derive out of this music, the nostalgia part, the memory parts, and so on. So when we talk about the experience of music, we really need to distinguish these two, and especially in the case of the subcortical responses, they're very deeply linked into these, which you might think of. I don't like to use the word innate. I prefer biologically prepared. There are sort of natural responses that get expressed in very commonly for most people.
Is there a part of the brain that processes music specifically as opposed to processing other kinds of sound?
That's a good question. Really what we know about processing in the brain is that large regions of the brain are involved in music perception. So just about any place you care to poke, it's going to play some sort of role. And some of these are, for example, there's a part of the brain at the very back and underneath called the cerebellum. And the cerebellum is a kind of mysterious little object. It takes up something like a quarter of the whole brain. And it's kind of bizarre because you can actually extract it. If you got a neurosurgeon and the neurosurgeon came in and took out my cerebellum, you would almost notice no difference at all. It's sort of an odd kind of structure. In a child, it would have enormous impact. It would make it very difficult for the child to learn new things like tying her shoes or walking or synchronizing and so on. It's in a way the cerebellum looks something like a conductor of a very good orchestra. Once you rehearse the orchestra, you need the conductor to rehearse the orchestra to learn how to tie your shoes and to do lots of other things. But once you've kind of got it down, the orchestra knows the piece, and you could actually take the conductor off the podium and say, let's just start. And the orchestra could probably do it all by itself without the need for the conductor. So the cerebellum has a kind of structure like that. And we find that rhythmic aspects, for example, are very strongly involved in the cerebellum. But really, I'm sorry I can't give you more detail, but the whole brain is involved when you listen to music. There are, of course, some structures that are more involved than others, but it's all over the map.
We're talking to Professor David Huron, who is going to be speaking at the symposium Music, the Brain, Medicine, and Wellness, a Scientific Dialogue. What makes a piece of music, for example, happy or sad, dramatic or light? Are these qualities that can be analyzed and understood, and are they universal qualities in all cultures?
Oh, excellent question. So we have been doing quite a bit of work on music and sadness. And so if we look at sad speech, so if you phone up a friend, and you can almost immediately tell that there's something wrong because you can hear the sadness in their voice. So what is it that we hear when we hear a sad voice? And what we know is that there are six factors in the sound that make the voice sound sad. So when a person is sad, they speak quieter. Secondly, they speak slower. Thirdly, they speak lower in overall pitch, so the pitch is kind of low. Fourthly, they speak in more of a monotone. So when a person is excited and happy, the pitch of the voice goes up and down, and they're speaking all over the place like this. When you're sad, you speak more in a monotone where you hardly move the pitch. The fifth feature of sad voice is mumbling. So people tend to, they don't move their lips very much, or they don't move their chin. So, and then the sixth factor is there's something called a darker timbre. So the tone color changes, and it's not quite as bright. We know exactly why these six features appear. We know physiologically where they come from. What's interesting is that when you look at sad music, and now we're talking about instrumental music without any voice at all, you find that in sad music, all of these six features are present. So sad music is slower, it's quieter, all of those good things. So we also do find these same features all over the world with music that within a culture people will deem to be sad. Now, where culture plays a big role, though, is that it turns out that the features of sad voice are also characteristic of sleepy voice. It turns out that people can't tell the difference between a sleepy voice and a sad voice or a relaxed voice. They all sound very similar. The same thing is true of music. So some people will listen to a piece of music and they'll say, oh, that's so sad. And then someone else will say, that's not sad, that's just relaxing. Or if we do cross-cultural work, often there's music, for example, in India, that when we play to Westerners, they'll say, oh, that's sad music. But an East Indian would say, no, that's not sad music, that's devotional music. So there are cultural overlays. So there are universal aspects to sad music that we can point to, and that all sad music, you'll see these characteristic features. But having these features doesn't necessarily make it, in a person's experience, sound sad. It'll also depend on their experience, their culture. And as I said earlier, it also depends a bit on personality. So people who score high on neuroticism will also be more likely to interpret a musical work as, oh, that's sad. Whereas someone who scores low on neuroticism will say, no, that doesn't sound sad at all. It just sounds sort of relaxing.
It turns out that some people really like and seek out sad music, and some people really not only don't seek it out, but they really hate it. And is that just random distribution across the population? What goes into that?
That's an excellent question. So we've actually done survey work on this and also clinical work and some hormonal work as well. Roughly about 50% of the population will report enjoying listening to sad music. The other 50% will not enjoy listening to sad music. There's about 10% of the population, or a little bit less, that actively hates sad music. They just don't want to have anything to do with it. And there's another 10% of the population in that 50% that likes sad music that say, I remember an interview I had with a Haitian taxi driver, and we were asking about his experience with sad music. And I remember it because it was so poetic coming from a taxi driver. He said, oh, sad music, it touches my soul. So we find about 10% of the population for whom sad music is the most important music that they listen to. It's the music that they derive the most meaning and the most enjoyment from. So it's not clear exactly what factors lead a person to enjoy sad music or not to enjoy sad music. Once again, personality plays a role in it. People who score high on neuroticism, also something called openness, which is a sort of openness to experience. People who are more experientially interested in lots of different kinds of experiences, they're people who are more likely to also to enjoy sad music. And we've been following up, doing work with a hormone called prolactin, which is released when a person experiences sadness. When you cry, for example, we find high levels of prolactin in a person's tears. The tears that you generate from chopping onions, what we call irritant tears, are exactly the same as the tears you generate when, you know, your pet dog dies, with the exception of prolactin. You have high levels of prolactin in the tears. And so prolactin is released when a person is, in a sense, it's a stress hormone. And it has a very interesting physiology, which is too complicated to describe, that relates to various aspects of pleasure. So you can kind of trick the system into experiencing the prolactin, or have the prolactin cascading to the point where you experience some pleasure from this. There is such a thing as a good cry, but
right,
not everybody
right.
has it.
Very interesting. Now, we talk about for example, when you talk about a composer like Beethoven who lived a long life, you talk about the young and the mature phases of a composer's life. And it seems maybe like our own taste in music can mature. Is there such a thing, in your view, as musical maturity?
Oh, gosh, what a great question. You know, I've never really given any thought to that question, but it's a very interesting one. There are changes over one's lifespan, but most of the changes happen by the end of adolescence. So the music that you listen to between about the ages of 12 and 22, what we call the reminiscence bulge, that's the music that will be most meaningful to you throughout your life. And you can see this, for example, in therapeutic settings, especially in geriatric settings. If you're a music therapist and you're working with elderly people, it's really important to know the age of the client you're working with. For young people, they might think, oh, there's no difference between an 80 and a 90-year-old. They're old people. But a 90-year-old will like music from their adolescence that an 80-year-old will think of, because they lived later, will think of as kind of old fuddy-duddy music. So, it's bizarre that you will find this even amongst elderly people. So if you're playing music that may very strongly appeal to a 90-year-old as a music therapist, the 80-year-olds in your group really may not find this very comforting or very enjoyable at all. So we know that large parts of a person's taste are really fixed by about the age of 30, but earlier than that, as I say, in this reminiscence bulge between about 12 and 22. And those stay with you for the rest of your life. That's not to say that you can't expose yourself to, you know, new kinds of experiences and new kinds of music, and that's certainly a laudable thing to do, and certainly good musicians and good listeners will do that. There's something to be said for, you know, in your 50s or something, starting to listen to, say, classical Indonesian music or something like that. In fact, there's a strong likelihood that these kinds of experiences have a positive benefit for stemming some of the memory loss associated with things like Alzheimer's. So you probably know there's research that shows that as an older person, if you're in your 60s or 70s, starting to learn a new language, anything that kind of challenges the brain, and is really a good thing. So there's something to be said for in later life saying, I think I'm going to try listening to, you know, traditional Thai music, or, I don't know, South Korean pop music or something like that. Just challenging yourself into a different way of listening. We know that this will change the auditory cortex. It will have developmental changes in the brain. You will see changes in the brain from these exposures.
There have to be exceptions to the rule that you just mentioned. There are people, and I'm one of them, who discovered the kind of music that they love the most in, you know, I was 30, and that put everything else into kind of set. And when I hear music from high school, I can't stand
you
it.
You cringe.
Pretty much,
that's
yeah.
That's great. Mary Charlotte, it sounds like you're the exception that in this case doesn't prove the rule but undermines it, which is great. I like to hear that. So tell me about the music that you what did you discover when you were 30?
Latin music, specifically
Latin
Cuban
music.
And Cuban and Puerto Rican music. Yeah.
Like salsa music.
Yeah.
Great. And did you dance too?
So whatever. Yeah. No, it was completely life changing and became. I mean, I guess, I don't want this to be about me, but this must happen to other people. And, I mean, the thing that you were saying about happy and sad music, for me, and I'm sure for many others, that changes over the course of a lifetime. There are some times where you like it and other times where you hate it. So, I mean, we're not really that fixed, even in adulthood, are we?
Well, there may be other things that have an impact here. Now, let me just give you an example of a piece of research that has been very informative. I remember a number of years ago, one of my students who loved to go dancing, and she had observed that the problem for her was getting guys to get up on the dance floor. And she had noticed that guys were more likely to get up onto the dance when you move to a slower dance tempo. Now, And so we actually carried out an experiment, an in situ, a real experiment in a discotheque. I think it was a Tuesday night, which is their slow night or something. And we got the DJ to agree to a one-hour random program in which the tempos of the successive pieces were all randomly organized. And I think there was a balcony there when there were four or five of us up on the balcony, madly counting the number of males and females on the dance floor. And she was exactly right. In our study, there were never as many guys on the dance floor as there were women, but you got a greater proportion of men onto the dance floor as you moved to the slower tempos. Now, this may have to do with style. So if you think of dance music, sort of 88 or 92 beats per minute or whatever, that kind of pooch kind of tempo, and if you move to the more rock-oriented tempo, the kind of and it may be that guys simply like rock more than sort of dance music. It may be that they like some sort of stylized Neanderthal stomp or something that's associated with that slower tempo. So the problem was that the tempo was confounded by the musical style. So we ended up doing a follow-up experiment in the lab where this time we distilled the music down to just a drum machine, what they call a backbeat. So it's just a bass drum and a snare drum. They're hearing... And they're allowed to tune the drum machine to whatever their tempo is. So we put them in a room, and we assured them there were no hidden cameras and nobody was watching. And we just said, you know, bop around, do your dance, and tune this drum machine until you get the perfect dance tempo for you. What we also did was we took a bunch of morphological measures. We measured their height. We measured their weight. We measured their hip, their leg length, a bunch of things. And it turned out in the end that it had nothing to do with being male or female. What predicted a person's preferred dance tempo was their weight, a combination of their weight and their height, in particular their leg length. So when you're dancing, it's a kind of oscillating system. Bouncing is like a vibratory system in which there's a mass component, an elastic component, and a force of gravity. And really what was going on was that men are just heavier. Men are bigger and heavier, and so they have a natural resonant or natural oscillating frequency that's lower than for women. So what we then did was we followed this up with a study of children, because the thing that one of the curiosities about children and movement to music is that if you have a, you know, 2-year-old nephew or, you know, a 5-year-old daughter or something like that, you probably notice that when you play the music, they might be jumping up and down on the sofa, but they're not necessarily and very infrequently in time to the music. They're just sort of bouncing up and down. What we've discovered is that music that's ostensibly designed for children is not designed for children. The tempos are way, way, way too slow. The tempos are designed for what adults think children would like. But children are really small. They have short legs and they have small body mass, and their natural dancing frequency is much faster than the kind of music that we play for children. So it could very well be that especially if you're involved in dance, that what you're finding is the music that's finally just the right music for your body morphology, for how it is that you like to move in the world, or what your body wants to do. Now, I'm not saying that that's, you know, the case in your case, but I suspect that it's a common experience for people that they finally find that music that's, this is just the way my body wants to move.
It would be so interesting to carry out that study in Cuba, in places where there's such a different dance culture, and where people really, where, you know, virtually everybody dances, and a lot of them dance to really up-tempo music.
Right. Wonderful suggestion. I'll see if we can get a grant to go to Cuba.
Well, I mean, another ending to the story that you said about there are fewer men than women on the dance floor and stuff like that. I mean, that's so much a cultural thing. And
yes.
there are a lot of people who are from dance cultures who come to the United States, and they're delighted because there's a gazillion women who want to dance. But in their culture, all the men want to dance.
That's great. Yeah, absolutely. I love it.
Now, you've done a lot of cross-cultural studies. You've analyzed the music of Native American and Asian and Balinese and all sorts of, let's see, Micronesian music, Saharan African music. What's the nature of these studies? What kind of comparisons are you doing?
So mostly we're interested in issues of globalization. So there's so much to learn about music. And what we need to do when we study anything is we need to have some sense of the breadth of what it is that we're talking about. A classic dilemma with experimental research is that we know an awful lot about U.S. undergraduate university students. We know a tremendous amount about them. And then we tend to generalize from the experiments that we do with that population and assume that everybody in the world is the same way, or for that matter, that everybody in the United States is the same as university undergraduates. So we need to cast a very broad net in order to just understand the breadth of all the possible ways in which music can be. And as a musician myself, I don't want to feel that what our research is doing is somehow dictating this is the right thing to do and this is the wrong thing to do, and if you want to have this effect, this is what you should do, and so on. I'm a firm believer that music should challenge people. It should do something to them. It should stretch them in a certain way, and I don't want any kind of definition of what music should be. Music should be all that music can be. So casting a wide net is a very important way of starting and saying, well, just what kinds of experiences exist out there? How do people relate to music? The problem here is that if we compare it to language, as you know, there are perhaps about 5,000 languages that are spoken in the world, but they're declining. That number is declining very rapidly. So there are lots of languages that are being lost. And this is very scary for linguists, because doing comparative linguistics is one of the ways in which you really start to understand how language works. If we only studied English, or we only studied English, French, German, or Spanish, or something like that, we wouldn't have the complete range of what's going on or what's possible with language. So in the case of music, it's far, far more fragile than what's going on with language. So all around the world, you know, if you go to South Korea, South Koreans may continue to fund and encourage people doing traditional classical South Korean and folk arts, but the vast majority of South Koreans are completely steeped in the Western musical language. And what I'm saying about South Korea is true all over the world. So Western music, Western harmonies, despite the fact that when you go on the web and you see all this fantastic world music from all over the world and so on, I suppose to the person who's not trained about music, it looks like this fantastic blossoming of all sorts of different kinds of music. But to the trained musicologist, when you hear, you know, Yoruba singing and so on, what you hear are the same Western harmonies that were described by Jean-Philippe Rameau in the 18th century. The language may be Yoruba, but the harmonies are thoroughly Western. Or when you listen to a Lakota, traditional Lakota, singing, doing traditional Lakota chanting, and you compare that to the recordings we have from around 1900 or so, which, you know, despite their valiant efforts to preserve their culture, again, the trained musicologist can hear that they're singing in the Western equal tempered scale. So there are all these ways in which everything is becoming homogenized. And it'll be a long time before everybody on the planet is speaking Esperanto or speaking the same language. But in the case of music, music is orders of magnitude more invasive. So it's very hard to find any place on the planet that hasn't been exposed by a tremendous amount by Western music. So when we go into these cultures and we run an experiment, we don't know if we find some similarities. Let's see if we find, you know, in Ulithi that there's a strong similarity between how Ulithians hear some particular aspect of music and how Americans do. Then the question is, well, does that represent some sort of cross-cultural universal? Is that somehow biologically ordained? Or is this just an artifact of the fact that they've been exposed to Western music?
Right.
So
right.
We're in this dilemma. We're in this very small period of human history where we can go to remote places, which 200 years ago was very difficult, or even 100 years ago or 50 years ago was very difficult to do. We can go to remote places all over the world, but in another 20 or 30 years, there won't be a place left on the planet that hasn't been exposed to Hollywood films and Western pop music and all the rest. So it may be 100 years from now, musicologists may be cursing our generation, because we're the last generation. We're the last generation of researchers who have access to these remote places and who have the opportunity to study people who have not yet been exposed to Western musical culture. And we're sort of asleep at the switch here. So a large part of what we've been doing in our cross-cultural work has been looking at globalization, and it's sort of complicated to describe the research program in detail, but we're trying to get a handle on some of these differences before these differences disappear. And if I might add just one anecdote, I think it was 2004, 2005, I had an opportunity to go to the Avari region of the Amazon. Now, this is a region that's actually closed, so you have to have special permission to go there. And I think 5 years previously, the Brazilian and Peruvian governments had set aside an area for a kind of national park, a preserve of some sort. And there was an expedition of biologists. I think there were 30 biologists that went in there. They had gone in there previously, and what they were doing was doing an animal census. So they had their upper story bird specialist and their lower story bird specialist and their howler monkey specialist and their caiman specialist. And I was very fortunate that there was one anthropologist who was in the expedition, and I was the one musicologist. And in the 3 weeks that we were there, we encountered three traveling groups. So this is the part of the Amazon where in 2001 they had discovered a new group of people who had never been exposed to outside culture. But each of the groups that we encountered, they all had transistor radios. What any anthropologist right. will tell you is that trade happens much faster than human contact. If you have a steel knife and you trade with an indigenous person, they're going to value that steel knife, but then they're going to trade it to the next indigenous person, and so on, and it'll make its way inland. And especially in the Amazon, I'm sorry for being long-winded about this, but I think it makes a point. Right at the equator, especially with a high forest canopy, the sun gets up at 6 o'clock, and it immediately goes down at 6 o'clock, and so they have 12 hours of darkness. And you can sleep for 8 hours, but then you're faced with what do we do for 4 hours in the dark? And you could perhaps set a bonfire or something like that, which will probably just do nothing but attract voracious clouds of insects. But each of these groups, they were in love with this plastic black box and the sounds that it produced. And during the daytime, they couldn't, because they were so remote, they couldn't pick up any radio. But at nighttime, when the ionosphere changes, they could get these powerful broadcasts from places like Manaus and Iquitos and so on. And so, although they had virtually very small amount of contact with the Western world, they were all familiar with Christina Aguilera and mariachi music.
Right.
Right?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm kind of horrified by how universal the power ballad is.
That's a good point.
I mean, really?
Are there...
There's Korean power ballads.
Yes.
There's power ballads in all of South America, all of
yes.
North America. There's power
yes.
ballads in all of Europe and in Russia and Australia.
Yeah. Well, it may be... So then we have to ask the question, why? It may be that there's something about those that is that we're biologically predisposed to that in the same way that all over the world people enjoy, sugar or something like that.
I hope not.
But then the question is, and this is precisely the dilemma, how do we know whether that represents some sort of innate disposition or at least disposed in some way? Maybe it's not innate, or maybe it's that each culture discovers this, and how much of it is an imposition from a cultural contact? That's a $64,000 question.
David Huron is a professor at Ohio State University in the School of Music and the Center for Cognitive Science. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure.